Welcome to Covenant Presbyterian Church in West Des Moines, Iowa. This educational offering is part of our mission to bless our neighbors to the glory of God. We hope it blesses you.
Well, welcome. Thanks, everybody, for joining us this evening. Our actual contemporary issues topic this evening is QAnon, or more generally speaking, this is your brain on polarization. QAnon has been in the news. It's been a lot of places in the news since January 6th. If you've been paying closer attention, it's been in the news for certainly all of the last election cycle. And before that, if you were really paying attention. I have been a little bit uneasy, partly for all of those reasons, with the idea of talking about this topic. It feels like we kind of need to, because this particular complex of conspiracy theories has been a really key piece of how the last election cycle played out. Of course, it's not the only piece of how the last election cycle played out, but it's been really important in terms of just kind of understanding what's going on politically in the United States. But here's why I've been uneasy about talking about it. It is too easy for us to simply dismiss this particular set of theories out of hand, and really more than that, to mock the idea of buying into theories and ideas like QAnon. We'll talk about kind of the content of QAnon a little bit, but I've been a little leery about diving into this one, because it's really tempting for those of us who don't buy into it to really get not just dismissive, but unkindly dismissive. So not just dismissive of the theory, but of the people who might espouse it. And so one of the things we're going to talk about tonight is why actually mocking the conspiracy theory is actually really dangerous, particularly when you've got one that is as consequential as QAnon has turned out to be. And it's dangerous, particularly in terms of the way that snark kind of impacts the people who do take the theory seriously. So I'm going to have a backgrounder on the theory that actually is going to come from a long time ago. It comes from last August, which is a very long time in context of not just the most recent election cycle, but in the context of QAnon. So one of the things that makes conspiracy theories in general, and this is a particularly nimble one, one of the things that makes conspiracy theories in general work is that they can adapt very, very quickly to take in new information and assimilate sort of new events into the overarching theory. So what I really want us to talk about is why that works. Why does it work in human psychology for us to be able to take new information that doesn't necessarily fit the theory and incorporate it into the theory while leaving the theory itself unchanged? You remember that old horror movie with the blob? That big like pile of jello that like moved through town sucking everything in. Conspiracy theories work that way. So kind of whatever they touch, they kind of suck in and make part of themselves. So I am again kind of uneasily, but I need to say it because I believe it to be true. I am naming QAnon as a conspiracy theory. in the sense that it sort of purports to be this master explanation of everything that's happening in the world, that is not grounded in evidence. It is not grounded in actual understanding of how the world works, which is not to say that people who espouse the theory don't understand how the world works, but that they have sort of suspended their understanding of how the world works in order to hang on to the theory. And we'll talk about why that is. But again, I want to be really clear. I actually don't want us to get overly hung up on the details of the theory, because the theory can move faster than we can, in terms of bringing in and incorporating new ideas. What I want to talk about is what makes sense about the way that people do buy into conspiracy theories. So I'm actually going to start with not something about QAnon, but something about politics, specifically the psychology of politics. And so I'm going to give us a 5-minute little video here on how politics makes us irrational. Politics makes us irrational. So here is a little explainer on how political polarization makes our brains not think about information in the conventional ways. So I wanted us to start there with the psychology, because again, when we start talking about QAnon itself as a complex of ideas, we may, and honestly, I hope we do, have some strong reactions to the complex of ideas that are presented there. And I hope that our reactions to those are actually more or less independent of our political leanings. But I know that they won't be completely independent of our political leanings. So I hope that when we take a look at kind of the rough outlines of what the QAnon conspiracy theory suggests is the case in the world, I hope that we hear that and say, that just does not sound realistic. But I also know that how we voted in November will strongly predict how realistic or unrealistic we find it. And the reason for that is that QAnon has taken sides. QAnon is not the only conspiracy theory out there. And right-wing conspiracy theories are not the only flavor of conspiracy theory out there. So depending on your political alliances, you will be more likely to identify with one or a different particular sort of conspiracy theory. So again, I want us to be conscious of this, as they suggested in that first short video. When we hear something and feel that reaction to it, like, stop and think, wait a minute, what am I reacting to? And what's there that maybe I need to be hearing that I'm not able to hear because of how it interacts with my pre-existing group identity and other cognitive biases? So having offered us that, I will go ahead and bring us over to QAnon. And I am pretty sure, I'm actually going to hit play here and make sure that we didn't, I have to riff for about 30 seconds, because there's a commercial spot that comes on first. So we'll get that going here. So there is your very brief historical sketch of QAnon. If you if you remember, they mentioned Pizzagate, which had been a previous unfounded allegation, and the unfounded allegation there from several years before the emergence of QAnon. If I remember correctly, it was that that the Hillary Clinton presidential campaign, if I remember right, was secretly a front for a child trafficking ring, a child sex trafficking ring, and that the front of the operation, I suppose the presidential campaign was not the front for it, but was in support of the child trafficking ring, and the front for the operation was a pizza restaurant. Certainly there have been there's been no evidence to support that actually having taken place, but this is the this is your brain on polarization again. If you already don't like that particular presidential candidate, and the idea that they are up to some terrible, awful, nefarious deeds in the shadowy background, you're going to maybe entertain that possibility. And you may never quite buy it, but you're going to be willing to think about it. This is the human psychology of how these conspiracy theories work. Sort of a piece of that has come in as kind of the primary sort of boogeyman of the QAnon theory is this this worldwide cabal of what are they, cannibalistic, Satan worshiping, child sex trafficking, remember where that came from, socialists, who are somehow running everything, running the media, running politics, running the deep state without being duly elected as members of the government. So once you've got that theory, once you've got that sort of as the master idea, then it becomes possible to bring in sort of any other event that takes place. You can interpret in terms of that. You can interpret that in terms of, you know, are they on the side of the Satanists, pedophile socialists who are running everything, or are they on the side of the strong savior who is going to take them down and expose them. And so it becomes a way to make sense of the world. And again, remember what Travis View, who is his full-time gig is keeping track of QAnon and studying what's going on with it. He continues to be tracking, even just in the last 3 weeks that have been sort of a complicated time for QAnon, because this storm was ultimately understood to be something that was going to happen on January 20th on Inauguration Day. That, you know, you've got everybody all in one place, and this is when you know, if the idea is that you've got to have this mass arrest, well, okay, you know, the election didn't go the way we wanted it to, but here's the inauguration. The election was stolen. The inauguration is going to look like it's about to happen, but really what we've got is we've just got all the, you know, we've got all the co-conspirators all together. And we can take them all out all at once. And so then in the last 3 weeks since Inauguration Day, sort of the newest shift, there are sort of two shifts that I have seen Travis View, among others, point to. And one of those shifts is to say, ooh, maybe this thing isn't right after all. So there are, in fact, some people who are questioning, wait a minute, what was I just following? And sort of rethinking and kind of putting a different set of facts together in a different configuration that that more closely matches what most of us would say is in fact happening. There is another thread that actually emerged pretty quickly on January 20th when the inauguration went ahead as planned, which was to look back at prior to the 14th Amendment, the inauguration actually was set to take place on March 4th rather than on January 20th because it took longer to ride your horse to Washington than it took to take a train to Washington. And so there is a thread within the theory that says, oh, okay, that piece was wrong. It'll happen on March 4th. That's when it'll really happen. So those are like your sort of current topics in QAnon. So these conversations are still going on, largely on kind of the less mainstream social networking sites. View mentioned 4chan, which is one of these sort of message forums. And this is where the original post from someone claiming to be Q, claiming to be a high-ranking government official who has this information and set that out there as kind of the beginning of this complex of the conspiracy theory. Even without Q, whoever Q is, posting new content, now the conspiracy theory is alive and doing its own thing. Again, largely in these less mainstream message boards. So if I remember right, I think 4chan may still be around. There was an even more extreme version called 8chan. There was a large exodus of especially QAnon followers from Facebook over to, you heard about the messaging site Parler, that in between the election results being certified and the inauguration, there was a big shift from Facebook to Parler for a lot of this, this conversation. Parler rented their server space from Amazon, and Amazon shut Parler down after the insurrection at the Capitol on January 6th. It has since resurfaced because you can move a networking site from one server to another, and so it's continuing there. It's continuing in some of these other again, largely not mainstream social media sites, but you can see some of these ideas crop up on the mainstream social media sites. Facebook and Twitter have both kind of gone after a lot of the most egregious of the QAnon content, but it's a very fast moving thing. And so it comes back almost as fast as a given group or information page, what have you, is taken down. So it's very fast moving. And it's very good at taking in new data and molding that data to fit the existing batch of theories. So, questions before we turn back to the psychology, which again, I think is the more meaningful place. Are there questions anybody has about kind of QAnon and what's going on with it? I may or may not be able to answer those questions satisfactorily.
This one isn't about QAnon exactly, but it's about movements based on conspiracy theories and information most of us in this group probably think is ridiculous. I tend to try to analyze QAnon more in terms of its ability to grab people, like McCarthyism. Most of the people on these screens, if not all, are old enough to remember McCarthyism, or at least having studied about it. And to tell the average person after World War II that the government was being overrun by communist sympathizers, that sounded a lot more plausible, I think, to most people. And I could probably come up with a couple of other examples. There's also the question of how the Nazis or any other similar group came to power, because the people in Germany were indeed feeling disenfranchised, some of them, but then clever manipulators fed them what they wanted to hear. And I'm not finding that parallel with QAnon so much. I've got a million questions, but that's it immediately comes to me that QAnon might be the only example we can think of if we think QAnon is so far out there that even I wouldn't buy into it.
Yeah, if QAnon is the only example you can think of, you are not thinking very creatively. And John mentioned two very clear instances of this conspiratorial thinking. So he mentioned McCarthyism, the idea that that global communism, right, and in that instance, more specifically, the Soviet Union, but the Soviet Union was kind of an ideological force in the sort of the mythology that underlies McCarthyism, and that so that communism is taking over the U.S. government and entertainment industry. There are actually very strong echoes of that in QAnon. The idea that there is this shadowy network of socialists who are in charge of the government and the entertainment and media industries, and they need to be rooted out. Which is not to say that there wasn't actual both ideological, military, and political conflict between the predominantly capitalist West, as we call it, and the predominantly socialist, the Warsaw Pact, right? Everything behind the Iron Curtain, right? So that conflict was real on a political level. And the idea that we can solve the conflict by rooting out individuals who are infiltrating our government turned out not to bear scrutiny, right? The other sort of complex of conspiratorial thinking that John mentioned in sort of pre-Nazi Germany and the way that the Nazi Party as an ideological force rose to power, again, kind of based on we can give you answers to why this isn't working, this being Germany in the 1920s and early 30s. This thing isn't working. We can tell you why it's the Jews. It's the Jews is a very easy trope in conspiracy theories. Go ahead, John.
I can also remember in my college years, which were roughly similar to those of many of you, I was friends with an awful lot of people who were quite convinced that the United States government was run by the military-industrial complex, and that there was a cadre of people in the government who were bound and determined to do all sorts of nefarious things to our democracy. And to my mind, guess what? That turned out to be somewhat true. I don't think it was quite the same as QAnon, because saying that the people running the Vietnam War were running it for their own self-interest is not the same as saying that it's run by a bunch of pedophiles. But I find parallels.
So let me tug that a little bit toward the psychology question. I'm going to just observe that in your telling of the story, the idea that McCarthy was right about communist sympathizers infiltrating the government and bringing it down, that that's completely ludicrous, and who would think that? But the idea that the military industrial complex, all of those words capitalized, is via control of the government willing the war in Vietnam into existence. Yeah, that seems right. That's my, your brain on polarization.
My main point that I'm circling around with, I realize without stating, is that I think we are all much more susceptible to this kind of thinking, even if whether we think it's conspiratorial or whatever, than we might realize. And,
exactly.
That's why I'm saying QAnon may be too ridiculous to most of us to think about.
Well, and that's where I want to back us up from saying this is ridiculous, because this is a theory that makes sense for specific psychological reasons. Those psychological reasons are not because it is logically entailed by the fact. It makes sense for psychological reasons that have a lot more to do with whether you're kind of like, oh yeah, you know, McCarthy probably had something going on there, or, oh yeah, that military industrial complex got us into Vietnam and wouldn't get us out. You're probably more sympathetic to one or the other of those statements, even if you know both of them are insufficiently supported by the facts. You're probably more sympathetic to one or the other of them. And whatever way of making sense of the world we make use of comes from a level that doesn't begin with the facts. It comes from a level that begins with our feelings about how do we feel with the way the world is going right now.
And I have one of the three things that have struck me about conspiracy theories in general, or in just in the Nazi takeover, et cetera, is they kind of promote three or four things. One specifically is the fear of other people that don't agree with you. The second thing is that there's always a scapegoat. It's always somebody else's fault and you're the victim. And the third thing is that those other people want to take something away from you. So for example, I don't know if any of you listened very much to the impeachment hearings, but one of the things I heard greatly, maybe it was my prejudice portion of it, during the President Trump's lawyers saying, in essence, that the people that everybody should be afraid of is Black Lives Matter, where what they're looking for is equal rights, equal opportunity, where, and I've heard this from other people, was like, they're going to take something away from me. There's not enough rights to go around. So if Black Lives Matter get rights, then that means that we have to give up something. And so that's kind of it's an attitude that is very difficult to counter.
So I think you are right on in identifying sort of, those pieces of the psychology. And again, this is stuff that you can put this together as if it's logical, but I'm gonna keep trying really hard to use the word psychology rather than logic, because this stuff doesn't ultimately answer to what your philosophy 101 professor taught you analytic logic is, because your philosophy 101 professor would tell you You need an established grounds for knowing whether or not you have evidence of this, that, or the other thing. You know, I can objectively tell that my pen is black on the outside, right? I can run a test and find out that it has black goo inside that comes out on my paper when I use it. I can find that out. That's logic. That's not what our political thinking answers to. Our political thinking uses logic to accomplish answers that we are sympathetic to in some other way, which again is not to say we can't be logical, but that we don't start there. And so the logic that the ways of reasoning that you're identifying, Gene, I think are very, very much there. Fear of other people, the idea that everybody's out to get me, and that somebody's looking to take something away from me. And you're not going to convince somebody that Black Lives Matter is a movement they should support simply with the idea that, yes, there are enough rights to go around. In fact, I could say, well, yes, there are enough rights to go around and everybody has the rights they need and they need to stop asking for more rights. So it's very easy, in fact, to say, okay, yeah, I'll grant what you just said and suck it right into my theory about how the world is put together. Bruce.
To back up Gene and John, the CNN had a special program last night on Nazism in Germany, and it's alive and well and thriving. They interviewed a number of the black-shirted rioting people who are professed Nazism, professed superiority, and they're being invaded by all the refugees from Syria, from all these countries that are getting bombed and whatever. And they resent all of these foreigners coming into their country. So Nazism is thriving right now, according to the CNN report I was watching last night.
So among whom is Nazism thriving in Germany?
It appeared to be a young crowd of, from teenagers up to probably 40, all right? And it seemed to be similar to the rioters who came to the Capitol on January 6th. Just a lot of angry, angry people who wanted to disrupt. And you think about how vulnerable all these highfalutin Congress people were. Every one of them could have been killed that day. And it's amazing how the senators and Congress people viewed the same event in a different way.
And again, what was the predictor of how they viewed that event?
Politics.
Politics, their political affiliation.
Yes.
And it may or may not be that one of those political affiliations had more facts on their side in terms of how they viewed that. I actually don't want to talk about the impeachment today, except as you said, sort of as an example of this same partisan thinking. Partly because the whole psychology of QAnon is and of conspiracy theories in general is much more interesting than how many Republicans were willing to break with the party and vote for conviction in this second impeachment. Bob.
Yeah, I think the the climate in Washington is a significant factor in this whole discussion. We have a divided nation, and it starts in Washington, where there is no hint of cooperation and working together. There are two sides that are bitterly different, and they're both fighting for their territory in terms of seats, but in terms of the media and everything else. There is no indication there that we have to come together. We're going to lose our country if we don't come together. And you would think that would start with our representatives. That's where we used to look for Tip O'Neill and whoever else to get together after they yelled at each other on the floor and have a beer and shake hands and go on and do the business of the country. It isn't that anymore. So you've got the younger generation. We have, most of us have lived through those good times. And I'm not talking about the good times of Republicans or Democrats. I'm talking about the good times of civility. When our people, some of the people in Washington could be viewed as statesmen or stateswomen. They're not there anymore. They're totally absent. They're totally playing to their base and to the next election. And they're leaving a void where I think these kind of groups can prosper, because people are looking for something. And it's not just Republicans and Democrats. It's all these off the wall things that appeal to their psyche in some way, shape, or form. I think that's a huge factor, the climate that we have in the nation now. And I don't know how we're going to get the people back together, because it's settled down into where we have families where family members can't talk to each other because of the political. It doesn't have to be that way. I just think that's a fertile ground for these really, I don't want to use the word kooky because Rev doesn't want me to, but I didn't know anything about QAnon before tonight, but a group of people that will embrace that are looking for something, and they're not finding it in Washington or in either of the, I don't think in either of the mainstream parties.
Go ahead, Ben.
This has a very huge similarity with young people looking for their community in CrossFit. I mean, it seems to
me. I love where you're going with this. Go for it.
It is coming our, what we needed as a generation is not fulfilling our children or grandchildren. And they are looking other places for community, for answers. And Bob, to your point, I agree with you that we are seeing them needing something. So of course you're going to have these people coming in and saying, I have the answer, I have the answer. And you know, where do they turn? But I'm just seeing that similarity of what we spoke about with the colonial logic and happening in the communities. It's all there and people are searching.
John.
I'm going to take the radical step of bringing faith into this just a little bit. Because
radical can you be? Yeah.
To Bob's point, and maybe other people's too, the disease is dividedness, unthinking dividedness. Now, I'm not sure that's totally true, and I don't want to carry that into a whole lecture, but some people have mentioned that. We as Christians could maybe set an example, not by standing on a pedestal and pounding our chests and saying we're better, but by showing how we are, I almost said above this, that's probably the wrong word. We're aware of it. And we've talked in other sessions of this class about bringing people together, bringing groups together. And that's the answer I came up with to Bob's question about how we can fight the dividedness. Is it necessarily true? Now, while I think of it, I also was thinking of my days. I was born in 48. So I think I'm a little older than probably anybody, but almost anybody in this group. But I remember that though my parents, I will still say, were as unprejudiced in the way we use the word now as anybody, I would still get doses of, well, they're Catholics. We don't believe what they do, and they're all up to something, which all bloomed when John Kennedy ran for president. There were a lot of people who thought the world was coming to an end because we might elect a Catholic, forgetting we almost had with Al Smith a couple generations before. But if people, I believe, by the way, that politics, and this is purely quibbling with language, politics is the art of getting things done. To me, that's the definition I have. And I was a sort of a quasi poli-sci major in college, and that has served me well in my thinking since then. But if we still, what am I trying to say? The use of the word politics to mean divided people fighting, there's more than one meaning to that. And I'm not saying the one that's been used here is right or wrong, but there is more than one meaning. And I hope that, let's say, Cindy Axne, who is of my party, uses her best political skills to accomplish some things that I want to see. For example, better health care. But there will be politics there, but I wish there were a different word for political.
I often try to differentiate the words politics and partisanship. Because as you're saying, you know, politics is about, is about getting things done. My poli-sci professor said the definition of politics is the process of taking any action that affects more than one person.
Like that.
And so his point is that the, political science thinking gives you tools for just almost everything, as you just implied. So this question of how do we get things done, and I think you're right that there should be a place for Christians and other people of faith in this. How do we address the things that are underneath this, as Bev said, the need for a group to identify with. And how do we actually bring people together? Stacy very patiently raised her hand a while ago, got up and left and came back. So I'm going to call on Stacy now.
How did she raise her hand, may I ask quick?
You go to more and it says raise your hand.
Yeah. So at more, or it may be reactions if you've got a reactions button to the left of your more.
Got it. Thank you very much. I was looking. I couldn't find it. Thank you. I was afraid.
I could go take a picture. So I actually wanted to make a comment on what Bev said, because, you know, when I was going through the things that Pastor Nathan put out there for us to kind of like listen to in preparation for this, yeah, I had a lot of your same thoughts that this is people that feel marginalized that really want to be part of a group. And, you know, when did we become so divided? And especially coming from a church where I feel like we really, really welcome inclusion and all that, how did we get to this point? And the more I listened to those clips, the more I thought, this is social media. The algorithms that are on social media promote your maybe wayward thinking. And then all of a sudden, all the information that you're getting is promoting this, you know, outside thought process. And where is the responsibility of our media? You know, I hate regulation, but where's the responsibility, you know, of those people to regulate some of this so that we don't get group thinking, you know? And it's scary that not only news, but also social media can dictate what we think and what we get said. And how do we know what's real and what's not real after a while when all of our news is possibly not real? So yes, that inclusion part, you know, really struck home when you said that.
Yeah. And so the question then is, or a question is social media run by a shadowy network of pedophiles and cannibals? Or does social media have a business model that counts on us keeping our eyes on that screen for as long as they can keep our eyes on that screen? And so that they are structurally incentivized to continue making us angrier and angrier, because the madder we are, the more we want to see the thing that makes us mad. Jean.
Yeah, well, when I went on all of the highlighted suggested reading or listening to that,
look,
you had
y'all doing all your homework.
Oh yeah. If you went on after one of the TED Talks, if I went on two other medias or two other more TED Talks, one of them was from a lady who had been a CIA diplomat and analyst and had worked for, come back to the States after being in Middle East. And then she came back and worked for Facebook for a very short time because she was concerned about how she could interact with terrorists in the Middle East than she could with other Americans. And her point was, to get to the end, it's very, very interesting, but her point was pretty much what Stacy just said, in that the social media's whole business model is to keep us at each other's throats, to group us and aggravate us so that we keep using screen time, so that we go on and argue with each other, so that we go on and always see what the next group is going to say and polarizes. And that is how they make their money. That is how they keep us on the screen. And I found that one extremely interesting. And there was one other one that was by a social psychologist who had come up with a testing on how we intake different based on our personalities, essentially, how we take in certain information and how we bring it out. So, for example, what she was saying was that there are some people that tend to be, because of the way they are, they tend to be more liberal and some of them be more conservative, and then trying to get together. But it's not like you're one or the other. You can float between them. But I just found those were just extremely interesting things, because I have the same problem within not my immediate family, but my sibling family. And some of these statements that get made is the same that I'm hearing from everybody.
Yeah, so this is very close to home stuff, and I love that you followed some of those kind of related videos. And you know, one of the reasons that I use so many TED Talks is that they're a nonprofit foundation. They're a really well-funded nonprofit foundation, but they actually have a business model that is not the same as Facebook's business model. So they would like you to keep putting your eyes on more and more TED Talks, but they don't really make that much more money the more TED Talks you watch. And so continue to be critical of what you see in these TED Talks. I am so fond of sharing with you. But at the same time, one of the reasons that I do that is that I've identified this as a source of typically well-credentialed information that is not there to make me angry, that it is there with some other purpose. And I guess the sort of the piece that I see sort of bringing some of those together is the idea that you're just supposed to get angry at something. That is the social media business model. It's not the only social media business model, or the only way to engage with social media. You actually can go out of your way to create a social media bubble that actually has voices that aren't just saying the things that you want to say. You can even teach the algorithm that you'd like to see more stuff you disagree with. The way to do it is to click on stuff you disagree with. You may accidentally teach the algorithm that you think completely different things than you actually think. And so you may stop seeing things you agree with. So sometimes you screw up the algorithm that way.
It's called salt and pepper. You put one in and then you put the bad one and you put the good one and you put the bad one and you wind up getting a little bit of everything, right?
That's right.
Because
The other piece that as Bev pointed out, the thing that we're talking about as well when we talk about the psychology of this is that alienation. I don't have a group that I belong to. And that is not to say that, for instance, every person who stormed the Capitol on January 6th was, completely lost, blowing in the wind, trying to figure out, who their people were. There may have been other reasons for someone to be there. Predominantly, folks who are drawn into a more extreme community are people who just don't fit in or haven't found where they fit and find that sort of the affirmation of a group of people in other settings. That is when you listen to folks who can talk about why they buy into the theory of QAnon, what they're really saying is that they're buying into a community. And it's an online community, predominantly exists in these message boards, but they're starting to feel, okay, these are people who I can belong with. And then again, this phenomenon of cognitive dissonance, then if your identity as part of this group is challenged by some new information that's out there, the human psychology of it is that you're going to make the information fit the identity of your group rather than vice versa. This is how the I really love the way that you acknowledged the this stuff we talked about 2 weeks ago about, why are people finding spiritual community in non-religious places goes right along with the psychology of people finding group identity in a conspiracy theory that, remember, the other way this reinforces is the more extreme sort of, I take this difficult position, I post something on my social media page that everybody in my family is like, oh, you're crazy, then I'm a little bit more entrenched in my group, right? I'm a little bit more committed to my group. I belong with these people who everybody thinks is crazy, right?
But in that case,
everybody is in the little quotes. in that case, your family thinks, yeah.
But the family, isn't it? You see a young person, they almost revel in the fact that their family isn't approving.
Yeah, that's there, you know? And I mean, Jesus said, I don't come to bring peace, but a sword. I'm going to set, mother-in-law against daughter-in-law and father-in-law against son-in-law and, parents against their children. So there's, this dynamic of, if I'm on, and I might be on uneasy terms with my family for some other reason anyway, but if I'm on uneasy terms with my family and I do something that makes them kick me the rest of the way out, psychologically, that's actually really powerful in support of the thing I just did. Warren.
I had a couple thoughts after what Stacy and Bob Hill said that maybe explains why we are, how we got to where we're so divided. For example, in transportation, my grandfather saw from ox cart to jet plane in his lifetime. That's the kind of advances we were having in transportation. Now let's go to communication. Of course, there were newspapers. And I remember my dad being so excited when he finally got a radio. Then all of a sudden we went to radio. And then you were getting some news clips in movie theaters. And then my family, there were several, thought TV is going to ruin this country. TV is going to ruin them. And we were one of the last families to get a TV, only because I kept going to my neighbor's house to watch TV did my parents finally get one. Well, let's take this a little further. Then the cell phone. Oh, my God, the cell phone. It used to be a doctor or a fireman needed to have a buzzer on his belt. But, we really didn't have to have instant communication with the rest of the world. And then to fast forward even from the cell phone to this, all these social medias. And this is only going to get worse, I'm afraid, with people now starting to work at home and not going to an office where they might have a break room where there might be some kind of intellectual discussions occasionally, not every day of the week. But see, we're getting further and further away from people having any civil debate among coworkers, among neighbors, whatever it is. And I'm really concerned that there's people that were forced to work at home that didn't want to do it, but now they kind of like it. And their employer really likes it. We're getting further and further away from any kind of discussion, civil, of current events. And Russ, I know, has an ag background, but I was in town till I was a second grader. And we had a porch. We didn't have air conditioning. And I remember some of the neighbors coming over, and I really remember three men and my dad talking about the Korean War had broke out. I was old enough then, eight or so, but they were talking about the Korean War, discussions on our front porch. Well, now, when I moved to the farm, then, back then, every farmer, because you needed so many people to bale hay or whatever you were doing, you couldn't do it alone. You had all ages and all backgrounds, even though we were all Midwesterners, we had that in common. But you kind of had people molding some of your thoughts, as opposed to me, being into my phone or being in, see, as a kid, my growing up, in the 50s, the decade of the 50s and early 60s. And I've not been able to explain the attraction that younger people have to social media. See, I have no interest in it. And to me, my phone is still just, you know, if I need to talk to somebody. But see, I'm way, way out of this general. But anyway, we're not face-to-face, young people, middle-aged, older people, you know, all the social groups, like the Masonic Lodge, the Lions Clubs, you know, there wasn't so many things competing for their time. You had adult intellectual conversation.
So yeah, adult intellectual conversation with people who don't see things exactly the way you do.
Yes.
But to Warren's point, I did hear the other day, there was a complaint by a person who had been in Congress. I can't tell you exactly who it was, had been in Congress a long time. And their comment was, things are not the way they used to be. I think somebody else was talking about here tonight, was talking about how they would get together and go to dinner or whatever. But their comment was, everybody jumps on an airplane and goes home. Nobody stays in Washington, D.C. like they used to. Okay. So they don't go to dinner. They don't have. So you had the day where you were in Congress and you might be on one side or the other, or you might be talking about something. But then in the evening, you'd say, well, let's go out and get a beer. Let's go out and have a drink and have dinner. But they don't do that anymore. Now they just go home and they spend all their time in their district. And then they come back and they do it again. So you're not interacting. And obviously COVID's not helping. I mean, the best we're doing is Zoom. But even all of the organizations that many of us are involved in, we're all either online or we're not doing anything at all. Or we're picking up the phone saying, how are you? Oh, good. I'll talk to you later. So the most interaction we're having is with our families.
So it is. It's this complicated situation of how do you get people to interact? And there's I've heard an argument made that it was actually a rule put in place in order to make Congress people more responsive to the people in their districts, encouraging them to spend more time back at home in their district. That actually took away that across the aisle golf outings and happy hours. Bob Hiddle has been unmuted here for a little bit. Do you want to jump in?
Oh, I didn't realize I was unmuted.
Oh, I was taking that comment, as like a really subtle hand raise.
Comment I was going to make in terms of the QAnon and other great groups like that. It sounds very much like what we used to call cults, except now it's not necessarily a group of people living together, so it doesn't have that character, but it has the character of one or more charismatic leaders that have tapped into something psychologically that pulls on people that are looking for something psychologically, and being able to identify. Being able to identify with a group is a powerful thing. And unfortunately, there's probably a whole bunch of groups that aren't the ones we would like to affiliate with, or we would like to have any of our children or relatives, period, affiliated with. And they're on both sides of the political spectrum. So it's not reserved for one side of the politic. But there's a group identity that has appeal to those people, and that's what we used to term a cult.
Or so similar. Bob, yeah, and I almost gave you as one of your psychology videos to study for this evening a video on precisely why people join cults, because the psychology, you're right, is the same. Which actually sets up, here's your closing lecture. So here's what you need to know about the people in your family and friend network who are down with QAnon, because whether you know it or not, they are there. And as Bob said, that's not the only one. What you need to know is exactly as Bob said, that this is a matter of the psychology of finding a group to belong with. The psychology of finding a group that says, yeah, this is us. So the first thing you need to know is that they do exist. They are people that you know. And I don't mean that as like a crazy nebulous threat thing, right? I mean that as be real compassionate with the people that you know, because some of them are already well down the road of QAnon in particular, of this rigidly partisan thinking more generally. So QAnon is one instance of this rigidly partisan thinking that breeds conspiracy theories. I might even give you tomorrow a link in the corner to here's kind of how to talk to folks and really sort of interacting across the, hey, you seem like you are really full of crazy ideas that I'm not down with. How can I talk to you? Don't say that, among other things. But the key point is you don't have this argument with facts. Don't bring facts to a feelings fight. And so if you wanna sort of bring this connection back, bring this relationship back from, hang on a second, they're posting things online that I just can't possibly be okay with. The way into that is with emotional connection, ideally about something else, because then you're not gonna push that same button. But to have some other, rebuild the emotional relationship between the two of you. And then maybe eventually this other conversation about that crazy conspiracy theory that they happen to buy into, whichever one it is. Maybe that conversation happens, maybe it doesn't, but what you're providing is the context in which they can recognize that, oh, this is not the only place to get my emotional needs met. Bev.
Thank you.
Is going to get the final word, in fact.
No, today, or was it on one of your videos? It talked about how to relate to someone who is in that mindset. You don't approach them without a hug. I mean, it's almost like embrace that person with caring and with questions of interest. Not saying, "Oh, what is QAnon all about?" But how, whatever kind of engagement you can get, you are going to be three steps ahead instead of one step ahead. So you get, just a little by little to create the conversation and security for them to speak about it. Is that correct,
Nathan? Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And you are offering them a secure, safe, interpersonal relationship that may never change their mind.
Right.
But that's okay.
That's their side.
Right. So, and this, that makes it hard, right? Especially if you're like really strong in your, what you are thinking and saying is a bad idea, or what I think and say is a good idea. It can be challenging to say, hey, we are just not going to agree on this. And my role right here is to just be in relationship with you. Now, eventually you may earn a place at the table to be able to say, hey, that thing that you posted really kind of freaks me out. Can we talk about that? You may get there, but that better not be your goal going in. because, you know, anybody who's going to get their mind changed is going to smell that coming a mile away.
The minute you say freaks me out is a big red flag.
Right. You need a lot of credibility with somebody before you can safely say, hey, that thing you just said freaks me out.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
But there's so many nice ways to find out.
Yeah.
But I wish I remembered where I was. That on one of your links?
I'll have to see if it's in one of the ones that I sent, because I can at least get to else. I can at least get you to one that says basically the same thing. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Hey, y'all.
Yeah, it was like one of the last links, Nathan.
Okay, great.
Thank you, Steve. Yeah.
Because I heard the same thing, because that's what intrigued me so much about tonight, is like there's so many people that I communicate with that have these very firm beliefs, and I've just been at a complete loss on how to respond or how to interact with them. And so I was like, that one was probably the most helpful.
And thank you. Take us one more step, Nathan.
Yeah.
We needed more of an outline. If this, then that.
And it really is, do I care enough about this person to want to have a relationship?
Yes.
So if that, okay, then everything else.
But it's no different than sitting down with someone of another color. You want to get to know them. So, you know, I mean, we talked about that in our things too. And it's like, you know, mm-hmm, you just sit down and you be yourself and tell them you're interested.
That's a lot of it. Yeah. And so that's why I wanted to talk about all of this psychology more than about the content of this particular conspiracy theory, because what we ultimately are about is these relationships, and the content can and will change, but that desire to be in relationship is what we're actually looking for. Y'all, you've given us a great conversation. Anybody who wants to continue the conversation is welcome to stick around. We can continue that, but I want to give everybody permission to go. Next week, if I haven't freaked you out enough, next week, Lent will have started. So join us 6:30 on Wednesday for our Ash Wednesday service. That'll be both on Zoom and on Facebook Live. So we will have a brief Ash Wednesday service, including a time to at least acknowledge the imposition of ashes. If you would like ashes, we are distributing some. So drop us a line and we can get a tiny little amount of ashes to you. Or you can come and I will personally place them on your forehead Wednesday afternoon during the blood drive. I will also be doing ashes to go. That Ash Wednesday service will also have communion. That all is to say that Lent will have started, and I have been feeling the need to talk a little bit about death and dying. I feel like that's like one of the things that we don't talk about enough in church, because it's so far, death has 100% success rate in the human population.
It's all a matter of timing.
It's all a matter of timing. So I'm going to invite us to spend a little bit of time talking about death during Lent, which seems very liturgically and spiritually appropriate. Next week, we're going to have sort of an intro conversation about why we need to talk about that while we are still healthy. So everybody stay healthy until next week so that this still applies to you.
Thank you for listening. Learn more about our mission at wdmcovenant.org.